Welcome to the Philacrosophy Podcast, where host and lacrosse expert Jamie Monroe will do what he does best, talk about lacrosse. Each episode will provide listeners with education, insights, stories, and lessons about the lacrosse world. We will discuss current events, coaching, philosophies, and college lacrosse recruiting. Now let's get started with your host, Jamie Monroe.
How's it going, everybody? Really excited to welcome John Crawley to the Philacrosophy Podcast. John is the offensive coordinator and assistant coach for Johns Hopkins. And John's so fired up to have you on the show.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. Been listening to it for a while. And, you know, last time we were together was, I mean, probably 5-6 years ago when I was at Colgate. So that was quite a bit ago.
It was.
Excited to be here.
The polar vortex. That was stop. I don't know. It was probably stop number 9 on the 12 stop tour through the polar vortex in 2019, where we spent one day at a Division I program in an RV, traveled about 2,000 miles, and had a great trip to Colgate. We talked a lot of good lacrosse there, didn't we?
Sure did.
Awesome, man. All right, so let's kick this off as usual with just give us a quick elevator bio of where you came from, some of the important people in your life, and we'll come back to them throughout our conversation.
Sure. Yeah. So originally, obviously born and raised on Long Island. So born Port Washington, New York, you know, kind of played a little bit of everything as I was growing up, football, wrestling, lacrosse, basketball, baseball, kind of just did a little bit of everything, was always on fields. And, you know, ended up getting recruited, going to Johns Hopkins, where I was coached by, you know, Dave Petromala, Bobby Benson, Bill Dwan, and some other volunteers throughout my time there. After graduating from Hopkins, was hired at Notre Dame, where I, you know, took my first volunteer assistant job, as many guys do to kind of get their foot in the door to coaching, with Kevin Corrigan, Jerry Byrne, Matt Carwick. And then after a year there, was pulled over with Coach Carwick to Colgate, as you alluded to, in 2019. So did a year at Colgate, then 3 years at Lehigh University with Kevin Cassis and Will Scudder. And then since then, about 2 summers ago, got kind of pulled back to Hopkins, and now kind of back in my alma mater, and able to be here and coach and be around these guys. So that's kind of like the brief one. You know, obviously all of those people mean a ton to me, amongst others. You know, obviously throughout that, you know, and when graduating, also continued my playing career, where I played 2 years with the Charlotte Hounds before the PLL, and then, you know, played 4 years with the Atlas once that change was made. But, you know, obviously countless people that I've been around made huge impacts on me, but that's kind of my brief story.
Love it. Charlotte Hounds, you reminds me, 6 years ago, I think I was a defensive coordinator under Dave Huntley, RIP Hunts.
Yeah.
And I think you scored like 6 goals on us. We put a shorty on you.
You did. It was my first pro game. That was an exciting one.
No way.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. It was my first crack at it. So, you know, I was lucky enough to play, you know, I mean, our roster was loaded. There's no doubt why you put a short stick on me on that one, because, you know, I was coming out of the midfield with Kevin Crowley, Mike Chanichuk, John Hawes. You know, our attack was Joey Sankey, Ryan Brown. You know, we were loaded. So I was just kind of, you know, we ended up losing the game. So you made the right decision.
Yeah. So I was trying to remember as I was thinking about that. Did we win? I think we did. I do remember though, seeing you play first back in your old FLG days, and my boy, Mike Winkoff and Corey Winkoff were some mentors for you too. Had to give those guys a quick shout out.
Yeah, no doubt. That was the team that, you know, kind of got me into where I, you know, put me in a position to get recruited. I, you know, actually the first time trying out for FLG, I think I was in 9th grade, I got cut. And I remember, you know, kind of that feeling, and then kind of turning it around into the next year and finally making the team, or maybe it was 7th to 8th grade. I'm not sure exactly the year. You know, played throughout my high school career with them.
It's awesome. So, and give me a quick recap on some of the other people in your high school career, like maybe at Port Washington, that had good, important influence on you and your, and who you are today?
Yeah. I mean, I would say to start, it was my dad. He was my first coach, in everything, from, you know, he did not play lacrosse, but he, you know, tried to figure it out. I remember seeing like the Lacrosse for Dummies on his, on our, you know, breakfast table, where he was trying to figure it out. And, you know, I, he was probably, and still is, one of the biggest influences in my life. He is, you know, work construction, you know, super blue collar, but really thoughtful, bright, creative, you know, kind of always challenged us to certainly work our tails off, but, you know, to think differently and think creatively and, look at things maybe in different, at different angles. And, you know, I would say he probably made a ton of influence on me. We actually started, when I was growing up, a sports program for underdeveloped, young kids. And that was kind of my first almost exposure to coaching, where he literally, we had kind of four seasons where we had baseball, soccer, swimming and gymnastics. So kind of like throughout the year. And I remember like baseball, you know, we as kids, I think I was in eighth, ninth grade, I was teaching kids how to catch a baseball, but like in two parts. I think it was like first those Velcro hand, you know, things that you hold with a Velcro ball that you kind of step on it, and then like crumpling a piece of paper and like putting the two together, equal, you know, catching a ball. And, you know, so we, that was kind of my first exposure to that and kind of thinking about things creatively. So I would say he was a huge influence on my life and still my career today. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, throughout in Port Washington, there's a legendary name, Vinny and Steve Sombrato, who are, you know, two of the best players of all time. Yeah. And I played with the Ficaros growing up. So that's their uncle. And so like my first exposure to kind of like free play, so to speak, was those guys, because I remember playing pickup lacrosse and, you know, playing in the summers, whether it was, you know, the Caniac League or the Denton Avenue League or the Alley Pond League. And I'd, you know, just kind of show up as a young kid and try to learn the game. And, you know, they literally, I mean, at 50 years old, 55 years old, were like running around with college kids and, you know, they were, you know, setting up, giving go cuts in different ways. They were setting picks and screens. And that was like kind of my first exposure to like how to move off the ball, before actually getting to college. And, you know,
so great.
It was a really cool, yeah, really cool just growing up on Long Island and being able to watch, watch different people play, watching different styles, being around the game. Obviously you mentioned, you know, Mike and Corey Winkoff, obviously, you know, with the club program, you know, that was a huge influence on me. And then my high school coach, I, you know, had a couple different ones throughout my career, but the one that I kind of always go back to is Tom Rooney, who, has now started Shore to Shore program and has done a couple different things since, but made a huge influence on me, my junior and senior year as well.
Really cool. One of the really interesting things that you just mentioned about playing summer league with a Sombrato is I remember myself as a player, as a young player, there used to be a lot of more summer leagues. Now it's all club stuff and you're always playing with your age group, which is good, but playing with older guys is such an incredible opportunity, not only to just watch what they do, but to play with them and have them communicate with you and do stuff that you would otherwise probably not do. And also in the parking lot after having a beer and like them talking about all the stuff, it's just this incredible sort of pass it down model of learning that I think was so prevalent, you know, in my day and less so now, but it's really cool that you were able to experience that.
Yeah. Yeah. It certainly molded, what I did. I, you know, they weren't the only ones. Like I played in a Long Beach rec league, like our, at the time, I think our rec league disbanded for a little bit in Port Washington. So I had to kind of like find different teams to play on and meet different people and do all that. And one of the programs that I became a part of for, I think 4 or 5 years was Long Beach. And there were a bunch of guys between Long Beach, Point Lookout and Rockville Center, on Long Island who, you know, I had already kind of looked up to, but then, you know, we would just play, you know, out at Nickerson Beach and kind of throw the ball around. And, you know, I remember vividly there's guys, Joey and Pat Candon, who were like, you know, some of the highest level there. And then Casey Gibson was another guy, like you'd watch him throw fakes and do some of that stuff. And me as a young kid who didn't really know the game all too well, but was just learning, you're impressionable and you learn, you know, you learn different things, you pick up different things wherever you go. Yeah.
I feel like in box lacrosse, in junior A lacrosse, and in senior lacrosse, the pass down model, both in Canada and on the reservations, is really prevalent. You're young and you're playing up and you just watch what people are doing. And it's so cool. All right, let's switch gears and talk a little bit about Hopkins. Tell me about your experiences there and what you took and what you learned and you know, how that set you up for your coaching career.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it couldn't have been more of an influence on me. You know, Coach Petro recruited me, I think going into my junior year. And I remember sitting in his office and, you know, fully just identifying with the things that he spoke about. And a lot of the way that I knew that he coached was very similar to the way that I was brought up from my dad. And I just saw a lot of similarities to it. So he certainly brought me here. And, you know, anybody that's been a captain for Coach Petromala, which I was lucky enough to be for 2 years, anyone who's done that knows you get really close to the Coach Petro. And, you know, he challenged me a ton to lead, showed me how to do that and challenge at other times. And, you know, I think that couldn't have been a more vital part of my development, even into today. But the other side of it is obviously as an offensive midfielder and attack offensive midfielder, you know, the X's and O's on the field. I wasn't necessarily with Coach Petro as much. And I was with Bobby Benson, who is, in my opinion, the brightest offensive mind in the game. And I learned a ton from him. You know, by the time I was a junior and senior, I mean, I was in his office 3 to 4 to 5 days a week, just either chopping it up. You know, I would see a play that someone else ran and bring it in. And he kind of created an environment for us as an offense to take ownership over what we did, because he gave us the freedom to make decisions and kind of make it our own. And that is like the cornerstone of kind of what I do now. I certainly have changed some things here and there, and it's not exactly the same, but you know, the idea of it, in terms of, you know, kind of like giving the players the tools to make decisions and understanding how we want to play, and then kind of like giving them ownership, is certainly a big part of like how I coach now. And, you know, not only was he that way in terms of X and O's, but like the way that he built relationships with us, and the way that we spent time together, you know, has an immeasurable, you know, impact on me. And then the other coach we had in Bill Dwan was an unbelievable balance to a lot of it. And he was a guy who, you know, would put your arm around you when things got, you know, when pressure went through the roof, and, you know, nobody kind of represented our program in a better way as a man. And, you know, so kind of like the combination of those things certainly molded to who I am today. And then the other side of it is players that I played with, you know, guys like Ryan Brown, who, you know, pretty much like him and I became really close almost like right away into the fall of my freshman year and his sophomore year. I learned a ton about shooting from him, about the way that he prepares, about the way that he thinks, the way that he moves. And we're still, you know, is my best friend today. Other guys, Wells Stanwyck, who was a couple of years older than me, who, you know, was one of the best quarterbacks of an offense. And in my opinion, one of the most underrated players.
So, you know, good
of probably the last 10 years, because our offense was very selfless and everyone moved around, but he was the orchestrator of all of that. So, you know, learning from a bunch of different people and there are many more in all yeah. of that that made
it. I loved watching that offense. Although I love watching your offense now, and I would say it's very, very similar. I mean, it's like I'm sure there's a lot of differences in, you know, from a personnel and perspective, but the similarities of the way you guys move without the ball, the way you run predictable, the way that you passed, the way you move, you know, gosh, you know, it was really, really cool. So it was a joy to watch. And then you were able to, you know, go to Notre Dame, have a great year of learning. What were some of the things that you took from that staff?
Yeah. That was
pretty awesome cast right there.
Well, no doubt.
All-star cast that you got to work with, basically.
It sure was. You know, I, you know, the that was where I kind of fell in love with coaching. I was not sure what I wanted to do. I really wasn't. I was kind of thinking about, am I going to go to grad school? Am I going to go to law school? I actually, in my time there, was studying for an LSAT, ended up taking it out at Notre Dame, ended up not using that at all. You know, I think from the start, like the way that they welcomed me in as a young kid was unbelievable. I mean, the relationships that I built with Coach Corrigan, Jerry Byrne, and Matt Carwick, you know, are lasting and are still there today. Because, you know, I would be at dinner at Coach Corrigan's house two nights a week, and then Jerry's house two nights a week, and then Carwick's house two nights a week. And I was always around them because I didn't have anything else. I was, you know, 20, 22, 23 years old. And I was just kind of figuring it out. And
what year was that? 2017?
I was 2018.
2018.
We won the ACC championship and then lost to Denver and Trevor Baptiste in the first round. You know, the things I learned from Coach Corrigan, he was just like the ultimate kind of CEO of everything. And I think that the way that, you know, our players played was very much a representation of the way that he coached them, just with a ton of passion, holding the standard, an incredible attention to detail. So learned a ton from him there. And then Jerry Byrne, I still would probably say is one of the best teachers of the game that I've ever been around. Again, you know, attention to detail of very little things about how to create an environment of seniors and players leading the younger guys and kind of giving them the tools to do that. So just learning from that and me not as a defensive guy, but kind of running the scout offense, it was something that I was able to kind of like experience firsthand for the year. And then Matt Carwick, you know, he kind of obviously was working with the offense more specifically, but the biggest thing that I learned from him was how to develop relationships with young guys, and how to advance those relationships, how to, you know, push guys to come in to watch film and get out and shoot on our own and all those kinds of things. So, I mean, amongst many other things, and I'm sure I'm leaving stuff out, but learned a ton from that staff and that year.
Amazing. And then you went off to Colgate. And that's where we really got a chance to talk. Like I said, I kind of knew you from afar, and it was really enjoyable to talk shooting, sit up in the office. I didn't go anywhere because it was so, remember the polar vortex of 2019?
I do.
And it was so cold in the back of that RV. I pretty much just went from the RV into your indoor facility and
sure. See
you guys practice. And it was great to watch. And it was great to talk lacrosse. And it was awesome to watch you guys beat Syracuse in your opener. Man, what an exciting game that was. I remember that so clearly. But I love the way you guys played offense. And it was basically, you know, you were taking Bobby's offense, right, and trying to spin it in your way. Talk a little bit about, like, what you kind of learned from that year being a first-time offensive coordinator at age 23. It's a big job, and it's kind of daunting, but it's pretty exciting to get the opportunity, isn't it?
It is. And I couldn't be more grateful to Coach Carwick for trusting me enough to do that. And I think that our year at Notre Dame and in the way that in the conversations that we had and all that, I think we developed that trust for sure. But there was a lot of failure there. And when I look back to the way that we practiced and the way that, you know, I kind of taught things and rolled things out, I think I was trying a little bit too hard to do everything the same way that I was taught originally, instead of kind of making it my own. And I think at times I was a bit too structured, a bit too strict on things. And while it probably wasn't very structured, but even now it's even less. And, you know, the amount of time that I spent doing partner passing, I mean, doing step down shooting and having them shoot one way or another way or dodge a certain way. And it just couldn't be more different than what I do now. And I think that, you know, having the ability to fail, and Coach Carwick giving me that opportunity, like I couldn't be more grateful for it because it certainly molded and you know, that summer put me in a position where I was like, all right, there are some things that we need to change. There are, you know, things philosophically, conceptually. I got to figure out better ways to teach it. And you know, we certainly had some success that year, and there were some really good pieces of what we did. But certainly, you know, a lot that I learned about what I need to actually not do. And you know, I think that couldn't be more important for a young coach. And having that at such a young age, I think really did help me and put me in a position to make those changes. And it's still changing. You know, right. Every year I learn something new, or I listen to a podcast, or I watch an Instagram video and see something that I like, maybe a little bit different. And it's certainly molded me into someone who is kind of forever changing.
Yeah. Very cool. And then talk to me a little bit about your Lehigh years and the role that you had and how that, what you learned and what you've brought along with you.
Yeah, I mean, those 3 years were unbelievable. The staff that we had, you know, headlining but with Coach Cassis, I mean, he is just an unbelievable leader of men. And you know, while you know, I think at Notre Dame, Coach Corrigan, an unbelievable CEO, created a great culture. It's just a very different vibe at Notre Dame than it is at Lehigh, just in terms of the athletic department and different aspects of it. And I think that what Coach Cassis did is did it in a different environment. And I think that I learned a lot from him about how to develop a culture and how to hold people accountable to that culture and hold people accountable to the things that you do. And then with Will Scudder, who I worked alongside for those 3 years extremely closely. I mean, you know, just an unbelievable energy, somebody who brings passion and somebody who gets their players to play with that level of passion because of the relationships that he builds with them and how much he pours into it. I mean, I don't know if there's a harder worker in the country than him. And, you know, I couldn't be more thrilled to see that he was able to step in to be the head coach there now. Because he's going to do unbelievable things. But I think every staff kind of dynamic is always going to naturally be different, like your day to day, so to speak. You know, at some places, you know, you meet for an hour and then you go off and kind of do your own thing. And then you kind of come back together the next day. At Lehigh, you know, we met, you know, throughout the day for extended periods of time. So we were doing a lot together all the time and learning a lot together and like had a ton of dialogue. So just learning from those two guys. And then others, you know, we kind of went through a couple different volunteer assistants, a couple different director of operations, but all of them having learned a ton from them. And again, like, you know, I think a lot of it is what you take from the year before. So, you know, at Colgate felt like there were some things I needed to change. At Lehigh that first year, some things I changed. And then even, you know, the years after that, got a little bit deeper into learning how to, you know, find a way to teach things better and change things for the personnel that we had, and finding ways to gather stats to back kind of what we wanted to do. And so, you know, that entire 3 years was huge for my development because of the guys that I was around and their ability to continue to have that dialogue and for us to bounce ideas off each other with.
Were you the offensive coordinator at Lehigh and running the offense, or were you?
I was.
Were you sort of running the same stuff that, you know, basically, you know, evolving from Colgate into Lehigh, and, you know, obviously it's not the same, but the same concepts of conceptual offense or principles based offense.
Yeah. Still running the same stuff. Just with some tweaks in how I taught it, just with some tweaks in how I learned it or how they learned it. And, you know, I would probably say the one of the more vital, you know, learning times for me was COVID. I think, like, you know, the my first year there was when, you know, COVID shut down after five games, and we were playing really solid offense. And we had a good thing going. I think we were 5-1 at the time or something like that. And we had a really good group, and I felt like we were doing some cool things. And then all of a sudden, that, I don't know how long it was for COVID, I started to, you know, really investigate and look into basketball, reading, listening to podcasts, actually ended up doing some Zoom calls with different basketball coaches. And like, you know, even then changing for the next year after that in terms of, you know, practice drills and the ways of teaching it, the ways of, you know, kind of like almost compartmentalizing your philosophy to different, you know, kind of categories. And, you know, so my, you know, kind of like, I would call it research. That year of COVID was unbelievable, and you know, I think that I learned a lot about different things that I didn't have really going into it.
What are some examples?
So for example, just 5-out offense in basketball. I did a Zoom call. Actually, it's a pretty funny story. I watched a video of a small school in Maine, on YouTube. And it was about five out basketball and like the way that they played and their rules basically that they had. And I kind of wanted to learn a little bit more about it. So I, you know, reached out to their head coach and their head coach, actually said like, actually that was our offensive coordinator from 2 years ago and he's moved on. So went to try to find him and, you know, he didn't have anything on social media or anything like that. Finally found something on LinkedIn, sent him a message to just try to hop on a Zoom call to kind of learn a little bit more about like the way that he, you know, kind of tries to put his offense in. He didn't get back to me for about a month. So I reached out to him again, trying to get on the phone with him because I was so interested in it. And finally he was like, oh yeah, there's actually been some people, you know, basketball wise that have asked me to hop on, like, do you mind if we just do it with them? You know, what date works for you? So ended up putting a date together and thinking that it was going to be something where he would like kind of had a whiteboard and went through things. And I think there was like 12 to 15 basketball coaches and then one other lacrosse coach, which was Bill Belichick's daughter who's at Holy Cross. I'm missing her first
Amanda.
Name. Amanda, who was also on the call, kind of me and her were the only lacrosse people, but everybody else kind of basketball from NBA scouts to, I believe there was a coach from Virginia, Army women's basketball. There was just a bunch of different people on it. And, you know, he led the call off with, so what do you want to know? Like specifically to me. And I kind of like was somewhat prepared because I had watched them a little bit and all that. And you know, we ended up being on the Zoom call for 2.5-3 hours, just talking about why leaving the crease open helps so much, why cutting instead of picking or screening and why pace is so important. And so just kind of different things that I could have brought with me. And you know, one thing that was pretty funny that I kind of look back on that I certainly feel like I learned from a little bit was, you know, I had to kind of explain to him that, like, you know, the difference between dodging a pole and a short stick is pretty substantial. And I think that that's different than basketball where, you know, if, you know, in basketball, you're setting pick and rolls to get new matchups. Like, you know, I don't know if that's the same. And he's like, that's just an excuse. It is absolutely the same. Getting a guard matched up on a center is going to give the guard the advantage in one way or another. And he's like, sometimes, and I, in his offense, he just didn't talk about ball screening at all. He didn't talk about picking. And it was more cutting and flow and just pay like straight ball movement and pace.
Why no
pick? Basically that it slows you down. You get a new matchup. It may slow your ability. You may have to pull it out. You may, you know, be so focused on one person. And at times that can slow your pace down. And he felt that, you know, if you just kind of keep the ball moving and keep cutting and keep creating space, you know, you could drive against whoever it is. If they are already moving, you're going to be able to create advantages and kick the ball out and get from there. That's where I was like, I just think it's different. And he was like, I think that that's what everyone in basketball says for a really long time when so often the status quo was pick and rolls with a big. But at the end of the day, if all you're looking for is matchups, you might not be able to play with as much pace. So again, something that I just learned from and just a different way of thinking about it. I still pick a ton. I don't know if I took it completely.
Yeah.
Into what I do, but there was something there.
Give me something that you actually took that you like, oh, this is great. And you're and to this day you do.
Trying to get people off of the crease more. And what he kind of spoke about was a study that was done about shooting percentages when people are around the hoop. Or closer to the hoop in the paint, and how when you're, you know, a foot outside of the paint, the percentage is higher. The study that he spoke about was about the distance from the hoop that the nearest player without the ball was and how the percentage of your shooting percentage changes the further away, and how much better your shooting percentage is the further away the nearest person other than the person with the ball is. So just kind of talking about clearing the crease, and because if you have two people on the crease in lacrosse and you send another person there, like, no one's open. So basically trying to create space for cuts, create space for dodging, getting underneath and getting to the front of the net. Those kinds of things was one thing. And again, another was just like the pace that you play at, and just trying to make sure that you're not too stubborn about getting a new matchup and only focusing on that, but making sure that you're playing with all six guys that are constantly moving. So, you know, there are a ton of things that I kind of brought with me from it. And honestly, probably the most notable were some drills that they did that were a little different than what I had done before.
Amazing. Well, like I said, I really love watching you guys play, and it's been fun to sort of talk shop with you. But maybe you can share with people your offensive philosophy and how you would sort of characterize the Hopkins offense these days.
Yeah, I think that's a long question or a long answer rather. But I'll try to kind of like keep it concise and
and then we can dive into other stuff.
Sure. Yeah. So, first of all, it's just an extremely free-flowing offense that uses all six guys moving with and without the ball at all times, with a, you know, a high pace to the ball and always kind of trying to put pressure on the defense until you find a great shot. And I know that sounds pretty, you know, elementary. It's pretty obvious on a lot of those things. But really what I want to create are problem solvers and decision makers rather than kind of blueprint followers. And I think that have a couple of different like kind of compartments, so to speak, at which I kind of like teach it and talk about it. But first of all, we kind of have four objectives to every possession. Number one is to set our space. Number two is to create an advantage. Number three is to attack an advantage. And number four is to finish. And, you know, the things that come into each of those are important. So for example, setting our space based on what set we're in. If we're in an open set, if we're in a 1-3-2, 1-4-1, whatever the space is, let's make sure that we're trying to get our space set as we're kind of flowing into our offense. And then two, creating advantage. That's you know, drawing a slide, it's setting a good pick, it's freeing someone up off the ball, it's flipping the field, so getting the ball from one side to the other, and then attacking that advantage is essentially working to not let one play two, working to draw and dump, etc. And then finishing is just kind of you know, making sure that we're shooting competitive shots. And I give our guys some tools into like shot selection and how that's a little bit different for each guy. So with the objectives, like that's going to be standard for every offensive possession that we have, whether it's a fast break, whether it's a settled set, whether it's man up, whether it's a broken situation, like those are things that we want to do. Now, the way that we play our settled sets is we have a couple rules that we want to follow. We got, you know, number one is our spacing with whatever spacing that we want to use at the time. I typically am playing out of a 1-3-2, counting from behind up. And then two is either you're dodging or you're passing and moving, and kind of the movements being cutting, screening, or picking. Three, we want to have outlets in front and behind the ball so that way the ball can move. Four is we want to move on a drive. So if somebody's dodging to the right or driving to the right, we want to move to the right. If we're outside of the scope of playing to keep our balance. And then the fifth is a 5-second rule where we don't want to be standing in the same spot for more than 5 seconds without a purpose. So again, like there's a lot to each of those things. Mm-hmm. But you kind of have your objectives, you kind of have your rules. And then as long as we're playing within those things, you know, there's a ton of different layers to all of that. And a ton of different decisions that come into all that. And there are a ton of different keys that we talk about every day about how to achieve it.
I want to go to the spacing topic where you learn a lot from the, by the way, was that basketball coach's name again?
I'd have to look at it. It was a couple years ago. I don't even remember.
Build assistant at Maine, some D3 school in Maine. You talked a lot about like one of the big things you learned was to try to keep the middle open. And yet you're talking about running sets like a 1-3-2 or 1-4-1 or whatever. How do you leverage sets? And then how do you also keep the middle open if you've got a set with two on the crease?
Yeah, it's just not, it's not going to be something that I do for each set, right? It's if we're in an open set, it's obviously going to, we're going to work on keeping the crease open so that way we can cut or dodge into it. But in 1-3-2 set, sometimes there are situations where you know, if everybody's kind of doing something after they pass and somebody passes and give and go cuts, and the next person looks to give and go cut and they realize there's one guy on the crease, one guy leaving, they probably have to make a different decision to then break off and go set a pick. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's kind of like the paint in basketball. It's like, how quickly can you get off the crease is really what I try to kind of, you know, push them to do, is just making sure that, you know, you're not standing around for no reason. If you're open on the crease, again, like that 5-second rule without a reason, right? Like, there are reasons why you actually do have to stand still at times, right? You have to either, you know, keep your space, you're open, you're an outlet, or you're backing up a shot or something, right? So like there are situations that it comes into.
Yep.
But it's more about like, how can we get off the crease? How can we get away? How can we leak off the backside to a pipe? How can I, as a crease guy, make an impact on the slide? How can I make an impact on the two slide, the three slide, the fill, by, you know, if there's a two-man game happening on the left side of the field and I'm on the inside, am I going towards the two-man game to go set almost like three guys towards it? Am I going away from it? Am I leaking off to X? How can that crease stay active rather than just leaving someone there to really easily have help towards? So again, I you know, it's little things that, like, you know, in practice, if I recognize that guys are getting stuck or we're getting have too many guys on the crease, it's just talking about how to get off of it, and different ways of doing that and making those decisions. So, you know, it's not going to be perfect if we're running a 1-4-1, which we don't do very often. But if we're running a 1-4-1, it's like, all right, like, how can I get off the crease? I got to find a wing guy to go play with. I got to exchange with the guy at X. I got to move, et cetera.
If you took a snapshot from above, from a drone, of your offense in the middle of offense of any of those sets, would you be able to identify them as different?
No. And that's kind of the point, right? That's kind of what I want it to look like, or how we want to play is kind of like marbles on a board, right? It's we want guys constantly moving, and you know, that 1-3-2 set most often looks like a 1-3-2, but there are times where, you know, we could be in that set, but it looks like a big little with spaghetti up top, and but it's all the same set. But based on the strengths of what we have out there, and what guys are good at, you know, that's where it'll kind of start to mold. Like you mentioned, you know, the teams that I was a part of, that 2015 team, like, you know, our midfield, like, we had Connor Reed, who was a really good, you know, dodger from up top, and he could feed. And we had Joel Tinney and Holden Cotone from the lefty wing. Like, we weren't making Joel Tinney go and dodge from the right side just for no reason, right? Like, everybody was getting put in their strengths. And we talk a lot about chemistry. We talk about it a ton. And to me, kind of chemistry is split up into a couple different categories. Number one is knowing yourself, and knowing your own strengths, knowing where you're good and knowing where you're bad, and making sure that you're trying to do those things at a high level. You know, number two is knowing your personnel strengths, and making sure that, you know, I do want our guys moving to all spots on the field. I want lefties on the right side. I want X attackmen up top, because I think it puts defenses in a tough situation. But I'm not going to ask a lefty shooter to come off a pick to his right hand. And neither should our players, right? If I'm passing down to a lefty, like, I need those guys to understand, like, we got to set our guys up, set each other up for their strength. So maybe I'm swing picking that, or maybe that guy's just passing and moving it along, and we can continue to play. And then, you know, knowing your strength and knowing your personnel combined with high level communication is, to me, really what chemistry is boiled down to. And if we're communicating before possessions, we're communicating during possessions, and then we're communicating after possessions about what worked, what didn't work, and how to do it the next time based on what the defense has given us. To me, that is like, all right, that's a high chemistry group. And that's a group that can kind of work together. So because it's so free flowing, you know, there is a little bit of a method to the madness, and it is, you know, while it is, you know, high paced and a ton of movement, it really is kind of six guys working independently, but also codependently, on how they're attacking, based on what we have. because at the core of it, right? Like if you think about it all the way back to like the base of what we're doing here is, you know, we're trying to solve a problem. There is a ball. There are six offensive players. There are seven defensive players, including the goalie. There is this amount of space. There is this size goal. And like, what do we have to our ability to end up putting that ball in the back of the net? And like, that's where I almost kind of reverse engineer from to get the guys to understand that like, there are a ton of ways to do that. There are a ton of ways to put guys in different positions. There are a ton of ways that a possession can look and should look as long as we're all kind of on the same page about that.
So cool. It seems like one of the real keys is variability. Variability, just in you're talking about, like, you know, if the ball's on the lefty side with a two-man game, do I go to that side? Do I drift off the back? Do I pop up? Do I float out high? Do I go low behind? And how do you manage this insane variability and have any idea what your team's going to be doing? Or do you really not know what they're going
to do? Yeah, I don't. I really don't. I can make assumptions based on what I've seen in practice and know that, you know, all right. You know, for example, a guy like Dylan Bauer, who's a midfielder for us, like he was a high school attackman and he likes getting behind the goal. Like I have a feeling that he might probably end up back there. I have a feeling that Matt Collison and Garrett Degnan will probably end up on the lefty wing. I'll push them to try to find different positions to still bring a strength to. But like, I have a feeling of what it'll look like, but at the end of the day, I don't really know. And you know, because of that, what I try to do is really do my coaching, in almost like drill design and practice and trying to create games to get them making a ton of decisions. And then all of us be on the same page about what's a good decision and what's a bad decision. And hey, why did you float towards the ball there? Well, I had a short stick on me. So I felt like I could set a pick, but then he didn't really use it. So then I kind of just filled that spot. Okay, great. You know, hey, why did you cut to the crease there? I don't know. I was just cutting. Well, that's not enough of a reason to why. Like maybe if this crease was open or if I felt like I had a step on my guy or whatever, but let's not do things without a purpose. And you know, that happens a ton in practice. It happens in recapping practice, in film sessions. And you know, I really want to like let the guys kind of dictate what it looks like. So for me, it's less like, I don't really know exactly what it's going to look like when our midfield comes out of the box. But I trust that, you know, through what we talk about in practice and what we kind of like the keys at which we, you know, work on, I hope that, you know, they're kind of driving the car at that point. And I think that they're making the decisions, that are best for the team. And at the end of the day, there are times that they don't, and we have to kind of continue to tweak and mold that. You know, I can't tell you how many times where, you know, we are, you know, in the second quarter of a game and we haven't had a midfielder dodge from below goal line yet. And it's more of a question for me. It's like, hey guys, why is no one flowing back there? Is there something that the defense is doing that's not allowing us to do that? Well, our possessions are only going for like 5 seconds at a time, so our midfielders can't get back behind in that time. Okay, so then maybe we need to have a little bit longer possessions. We need to be a little bit more patient about what we're doing so we can get everybody everywhere. So it's kind of just a constant dialogue and conversation where I'm kind of helping tweak their decision making and give them some little things during games that, you know, maybe I see in my week of preparation that can help them. But at the end of the day, it's those guys attacking their guys, it's those guys, you know, attacking them with a couple key things at heart, right? It's you know, how good is our spacing? How's our pace with and without the ball? You know, are we slowing down? Are we speeding up? Are we moving too much? Are we moving too little? is the ball getting stuck on one side of the field, right? Like that's kind of what I'm evaluating throughout games. It's like, all right, how can we tweak and how do we get them to do that? And then again, I spoke about drill design. Like in practice, if there's a game where I felt like we were super stagnant off the ball, it's like, all right, I've got to create some games and drills to put them in positions to move more. And then we do a little bit of that. We talk about those decisions to move or not move. And then we kind of continue go back and forth from there. So the you know, I think it's the fun part of coaching an offense like this, where there is a ton of variability, because you kind of are creating your own architects. You're kind of creating your own offensive coordinators, so to speak, on the field. So that way, you know, at the end of the day, they're making decisions based on what they see that the defense has given them. Right. So then they're driving the ship rather than you.
I feel like there's, it's so hard for some people, coaches, anybody, to wrap their head around, I don't know what's going to happen. Like it's so much more comfortable if you know you're running, you know, a three out high wing, four man rotation, you know, within four mid, you know, you clear fade the attack, float or follow with the crease guy, cut the backside midi, and you kind of know what you're getting, and it feels good because you like at least know what you're going to get. But on the other hand, so does your opponent. And in the end, any look, I'm guessing when I say this, but any look that you could love in any offense, and I always say so many good looks, so little time, right? I mean, there's so many good things to do, but
No
every
doubt.
single one of them can happen in your offense. And it's more a matter of we want to get this look of our lefties dodging, you know, from, you know, this wing or low, or get our best players behind, or have this pick action here, this pick action there, or this off-ball action here, or, you know, this mirror here, or this float out here, all the looks that you could possibly want. It's more a matter of how do you get there, and can you get there in ways that are unpredictable and variable and not necessarily scripted? And I think that's the part that, you know, everybody would love to do, but it's just hard to trust that it can get there. And because you don't know how you're going to get there. But it's similar to making decisions, you know, in solutions. You talk a lot about solutions, but skills are solutions too. And, you know, you rattled off a way, you know, with your guys you played with, you know, in college, you know, whether it's Tinney or whether it's Wells or Ryan Brown. They all did stuff very differently. They all played incredibly differently, and they couldn't have played exactly like each other. And it's kind of the same thing every time with every player and with every offense. And I just, the reason why I'm bringing it up like this is just because I know there's a ton of coaches that want to do this, but it's like hard for them to wrap their head around it. And so maybe you could speak to kind of how you've gotten there and how you kind of get, you know, pick five or six looks that you love from a traditional offense and how you end up sort of getting it done in your offense, maybe three or four, whatever. But just give us an idea so a high school coach could take this and say, I can do this.
Sure. I think the root of it is that, like, as a you know, as a freshman, Coach Benson put an offense like this in, and I was able to play in it and kind of watch it and feel it develop as a player and feel myself learn how to make reads for my own, for myself. And I think, like, that's kind of where it starts. And by the time I was a junior and senior, you know, I was kind of helping coach as a player, and you know, I felt like I had more ownership over it, rather than being told exactly what to do. So it is a little bit longer of a you have to commit to it in a lot of ways, and you kind of have to jump into it. But there are other kind of influences. I mean, you know, Rob Gray writes an unbelievable book in terms of how we need to move, or how we learn to move. You know, I listen to basketball podcasts. I think it's like Chris Oliver does a pretty cool podcast, the Basketball Podcast, where he has different basketball coaches on, and they talk about kind of philosophy, and very similar to your podcast for lacrosse. And you know, I think that over time, you know, after hearing so many different situations about the benefits of it, you know, you kind of just have to tweak how you teach it. And I think my first year at Colgate, like I said, like I was way, like, even though it was unstructured, I was even like too structured with how it should look. I was too structured with how guys should shoot, too structured about how guys needed to pass the ball. And you know, after seeing that kind of hold some people back, you know, I've made those adjustments over these past couple of years to allow guys to kind of, you know, learn how to play to their strengths and do that from different areas of the field. And you know, in terms of actions, I actually don't really, like, you know, I do have a couple things, you know, like the, you know, a nation's look, a, you know, a staggered pick and things like that, but I actually don't really talk about them that much. They just happen, and they just happen because the guys, maybe it's just because I've got some really good players and some really smart guys, you know, but like, I don't necessarily have to talk to two righty Canadians about how to play the two-man game on the right side and have to micromanage it. Like, I put them in positions to do that, and then they've got to kind of figure that out, and then we kind of like tweak decisions here and there. So again, like I really do think that you need to if you do kind of go this direction, you need to rethink in how you train it, and how you coach it and the drills that you do, because that's going to be kind of where a lot of their learning comes in. And then you're able to kind of steer the ship via film and via, you know, stopping different times and practices to adjust decision-making and things like that. But I think you also need to have some sort of a direction in what your identity is. So, you know, for example, if I know that like we want to play at a high pace and have high urgency with and without the ball, like I need to make sure that the drills in practice, our body language is never bad and the ball is constantly moving fast and we're not slowing down, because if I allow it to happen in certain drills in practice, then I don't know if it's going to translate all the time to what we do while we're out on the field. So I think that you have to kind of have like an identity of what you want it to look like, so to speak. And then you kind of have to reverse engineer that to how you train it. But it's fun. And I think you also have to be okay with failure. And if you fear failure, and your players will certainly fear failure. Yeah. But, you know, as a coach, like, I'll tell you what, like during team practices is usually my time where, if we have, let's say, a 30-minute segment with the offense, I'd probably say 80% of the drills that I do are things that I know and have done before, but like 20% of them are probably like new and I might get it wrong and it may not be a great drill, but I am trying to find something to create an environment that puts them in a situation to solve a certain problem. Where, you know, actually during the individuals segment that we were just in during the winter, where we were kind of together only for 2 hours a week, I actually was experimenting with like 70% of my drills, rather than like doing the things that we already knew how to do. And there were times in practice where, you know, maybe a drill didn't go the way that I wanted it to go. And I tweaked it once or twice and I was like, all right, it's over, let's kill it. And it maybe that wasn't a good one. And our guys, you know, you kind of have to be vulnerable with your players and the fact that like, I'm trying to get this right too, you know, and I, the same way that you guys are, you know, I'm going to have to experiment with some things to figure out how to make this group as good as it can be, because it's different than the last group that, you know, the way that they played. So, you know, being honest with your players, transparent, I think is an important aspect of this. Is like, hey guys, we're trying this and we're going to tweak it. We're going to go from there. Everything is going to be with the best interest of this team at heart. And the same way, you know, if you try something and it doesn't work, like I'm going to tell you that you tried it and it didn't work. So that way we can kind of continue to adjust and mold together. You know, it's definitely puts you in a vulnerable spot as a coach, to not know exactly what it's going to look like. But if you can start to develop some trust in your players, and you can truly trust, that the outcome on the other end of it is going to be a group of guys who A, have ownership over it, B, are making decisions at a high clip, and C, is creating a more efficient offense that's harder to cover. You know, I think that you got to be willing to kind of make that jump.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's not like you don't struggle when you have structure. It's not like you're not going to have failure. You're going to have failure no matter what you do.
Yeah.
The fact is, though, it's like, why pick like 50 or 100 words out of the dictionary and just focus on those ones instead of let your offense be the entire dictionary? I mean, honestly, like it's like you still have to figure out a way to score goals, and you're going to do all the things that you would do in any offense. I mean, what would characterize any good offense? Like you said, spacing, ball movement, reading the defense,
yeah,
communication, actions, dodging. Where do you want to dodge from? Well, I want my best players dodging from their strongest points, but I want to change it up so it's not too predictable. And so it's kind of like more like how you get there. And it's the same thing with skills. It's like, you know, telling someone they have to shoot this way when really the object is get the ball from A to B. You know, it's more about possession than it is like technique. It's, you know, about, you know, the principles would be possession or communication or deception or handling pressure. You know, as envision, you know, let them figure out how they'll do it, and they'll figure it out in different ways for different situations instead of us as coaches picking it for them and making them fit a square peg in a round hole half the time. And it feels great when it works great, but in the toughest of situations, it's more predictable.
Yeah, and I think you could still have some non-negotiables, right? Like there can absolutely be some things like, you know, with shooting. I think originally I was talking about like five or six different like things that were non-negotiable, and now I like, you know, kind of simplify it to like, all right, we want to finish with our back shoulder at the net as best we can, with a good shot. And more of what I talk about with shooting is less about how you're shooting it and more of the selection of the shot.
Shot selection is a non-negotiable, because if you take bad shots, you're going to lose. I mean, whether angle distance, you know, whether you're open or not, different person for different selection for different people, like you already said. But how you do it's going to be a little different for everybody.
No doubt. No doubt. How you do it
No
is going
doubt
to.
that you're probably going to hit the cage more overhand than you are underhand. You know, but you have to be able to do it all. I mean, I feel like it's a little like easier from a consistency perspective to lift somebody up and throw, but that doesn't mean that you look at Ryan Brown, he was a master of both. Certain players might do things better, you know, than one way than another. But in the end, it's more like getting the job done and then trying to figure out with them, like, well, what do you think is your best shot? What's your next best shot? Right. And then like
That's
I noticed, like, you miss the cage all the time when you shoot this way, but you tend to score more goals this way. Do you ever notice that? Right.
exactly, and that's where the approach that I've gone to a lot more of. You know, I do kind of have a cornerstone of what everybody wants to be at. You want to be, you know, around 30, 33 to 35% shooting, depending on your position. But like, you know, I do a project every spring break where, you know, I'll break down every shot that they took throughout the season that thus far. And you know, the acronym that I'll have that I use is RAMPS. So range, angle, momentum, placement, situation. And they have to kind of basically get a feel for why a shot worked or why a shot didn't work. And you know, it was if it didn't work, it's either A, you know, you it was a bad decision to shoot. You probably shouldn't shoot that shot because of any of those categories. Or B, you know, it's something that you had to practice more. And I think the biggest adjustment that guys have to understand is like practice more doesn't necessarily mean like go out with a bucket of balls solo and shoot the ball to the bottom corner over and over and over. It's like you have to put yourself in the environment that you're getting that shot in. So for example, if let's say Garrett Degnan gets seven shots from the lefty wing, and you know he's scoring, let's say this isn't the case, but let's say he only scores two of them, and he's under that 33%. It's like, all right, let's look at the other four shots and see, you know, why it changed, where it changed. Was it a righty goalie, a lefty goalie? There are just so many different variables that you can do, but you got to work on that shot, and you got to find a way to put yourself in that environment. If five of them had an approach coming at you from below goal line to coming towards you, and that was kind of rattling you, you might need somebody to come out and be an approach so that way, like somebody feeds and on the feed, they leave, they send their stick head out to you, and you're getting used to shooting with that kind of pressure. So, you know, I think that you know, we do that project, and then actually a lot of times the rest of the season, I have them design their own shooting drills in practice. And they have to design it with maybe the scout defense. And they have to tell the scout defense, hey, I'm struggling with this shot up the hash. So you're going to have to stand about a yard and a half behind me with your stick in my gloves. And I'm going to get up the hash and shoot it on the goalie. And I'm going to do that over and over until I feel comfortable with it. So, you know, I think that you have to adjust your training, your drills, and the things that you focus on to more focus on like the per player, and helping them get the job done, however that takes.
So cool. All right, last topic. You mentioned Rob Gray in his book on movement. It's all about the constraints-led approach and ecological psychology and dynamical systems and how human beings actually operate. And it sounds like you are leveraging these concepts in your coaching, which is one of the reasons why you're changing things up, because variability is proven to help more to players to be more adaptable. And what I want, and you're taking it all the way to your offensive schemes, from all the way back down to how you're developing players in context. It's just not about hitting the spot. It's about the context of a slide coming at you, or a, you know, baiting a check so you can shoot after the check, whatever it is. And what I wanted to chat about And you mentioned this, it was really interesting that you did like 70% new drills. So many coaches are afraid to try anything new because they don't want to, they need it to be perfect. But what I think you're doing is massively accelerating your own coaching knowledge, because what you're getting so good at doing is recognizing what was the cause and effect? What did this constraint create? And when you say, did it work? It's really like, what happened? Mm-hmm. And I feel like your player's ability to make decisions are all relative to their perception, mm-hmm. but it's no different for the coaches. Sure. And the more the coaches create variability and the more that they can see what is actually happening and do I like this? Is this what I want? Sometimes you get something out of it you didn't know, and you're like, I love this. And sometimes you're like, yeah, it's not working. And you have to tweak some constraint. Maybe it's a time constraint. Maybe it's a space constraint. Maybe it's numbers. Maybe it's long poles. Maybe it's the goal size. Maybe it's whatever. But the deal is that what I wanted you to sort of talk about is how much has this improved you as a coach going down this path of true exploration of constraints and true recognition of how they are actually working or what's actually happening?
Yeah. I mean, that there's a lot there, right? I think that where it all starts for me is, all right, what's the purpose of today? Like, what is the if I'm going into a practice plan and I've got 30 minutes, what am I trying to work on today? I have somewhat of an installation plan that I'll have. And then, you know, all right, what did we want to get done by this week or whatever it is? That is always changing and you always mess it up and it's never perfect and whatever, but you're able to make those adjustments as you go. But if let's say I want to work on, and let's say our spacing the day before was terrible and I'm watching the film and I'm watching the consistency of our spacing not being very good. Okay. What is the purpose of the drill that I'm going to do? And then you can kind of have somewhat of a drill bank to go towards, that, you know, you can basically tweak different games to do. And I think that actually where it kind of advances kind of what I've done is at times I felt like I almost had too many drills, and too many different kind of ideas to get through. So I've had to kind of like dial it into like five main games that we're playing out of, or five or six main games that I'm playing out of, but like tons of different ways to kind of play each of those games. So it's forced me to be more detailed and specific about like, all right, let's say we're playing 4x, for example. You know, they need to know 4x in so many different, like they need to understand that. And I need to understand what we're getting out of that so well, that I'm able to tweak one thing to get what we want out of it. So here's an example. I want to work on picks behind in 4x, or I want to work on picks behind. I choose 4x as the game I want to play because you get a ton of picks and you're able to get a ton of reps at the communication. And you know, you're putting them in spots to make decisions consistently. Then all of a sudden you get out to 4x and you realize that the two defenders are just standing at the pipes and you're getting no picks behind the goal. You have to be able to recognize that and blow the whistle and say, okay, what is going to actually create this situation of happening? And I know you and I have spoken about this a little bit, but like, all right, now we got to adjust. The defense has to play the ball behind.
Yeah.
Okay. Defense has to play the ball behind. Now there is somebody on the ball. Now you are actually setting up a pick and now you actually are coming off of it and having to set it at an angle that makes sense and that actually connects on the pick. So like you're forced as a coach to be super vigilant to like, A, what's the purpose of this drill? What is the purpose of this day? And then B, what are the tweaks that you need to make to constantly get back to that purpose if that's something that you want to happen? And again, like that's just something that, you know, for the more familiar that you get with like five or six drills or five or six games, the more you're able to adjust the constraints and get to a point where you know what you're going to get out of an adjustment. And that's hard to do because there are so many different drills that you can possibly do out there. The same way that you were talking about, there are so many different plays or sets or actions that you can choose from. But like, all right, what are like the five or six things that we like, games that the guys know, games that the guys have fun with, environments that are going to create for a ton of variability. And then like, I have to be in charge of designing that to make sure that we're still staying on task with what we're doing, because that to me is going to be more learning than if I was to put, if we're going to talk about picks behind the goal and I have, two guys back there and there's no defense and they run off a pick, they get up to the island, they throw it back to X, they go attack the other side. Like, you're not picking anybody. You're not deceiving somebody from going one direction to then go the other. There's no read after it.
No decision.
And you're running about probably double or triple the amount that you can run in terms of making decisions, which to me, it's a decision-making game. And if you can think fast and you can play fast consistently in your head, that's going to lead to your pace being high while you're out on the field. So again, like, it all has to kind of reverse engineer based off of what you want to work on and
And
kind of
what you hope to get, and how you intentionally leverage the constraints. I mean, you answered the question so perfectly, and I want to reiterate it. If you're playing like you can do. It's not like your drills are all that different. You're playing like 2-on-2, 3-on-2, 3-on-3, 4-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-4, 5-on-5, right? It's all the same stuff that everyone's doing. The difference would be the constraints. So when you're 4-by-game, you have a smaller net. And you're playing a game with all short sticks, and it's like make it take in hoops, or if you clear it out when you change possessions, and then the constraints within that are like, I want to get actions behind the net. Oh, but the defense isn't playing behind the net. Oh, I need to make a constraint where the defense has to play the ball behind the net. Now we can get a two-man game behind the net. And it's still kind of a 2-on-1 unless you say, hey, I want the pickers man to have be covered and the ball. And then you can sort of pick your own constraints. And tweak them from there, and whatever it is. And it could be your defensive coverage, which is critical. You got to change up the defensive coverages all the time and everything you do, right? And that changes what you would want. We're going to play a team that plays defense this way. We got to play that defense. But you, or it could be the offensive action. These are where all the actions come in. Well, I want to get picks on the ball side and picks on the backside, or I want to get a three-man side, or whatever it is. And you just kind of let them go do it within the principles. Maybe you have a space constraint. If you want to, make them play faster and tighter, you take your 4-by and really tighten it up. And now it's like they have to like really see their next pass before they get the ball. Or maybe it's a shot clock constraint where you're like, oh, you got 15 seconds with the ball. And these are the things that you then have to recognize is what is actually happening. It's not is what I want happening. It's like what is happening. And then you're like, oh, I love that. Or it's not really what I wanted, and so sort of to go from there. So really, really well
The
stated.
other side of it is like taking it as trying to get the guys to take it as seriously as they do a 6-on-6 segment. And you're going to make mistakes, there's no doubt about it. So we have kind of constraints to kind of work on that, right? We have like let's call it, if there are 5 or 6 person teams and one person's up at the balls and he's able to just throw the balls in whenever there's a turnover, we're not thinking about turnovers, we're just thinking about these actions. You're able to kind of change what the intention of the drill is, but you're able to do it in so many different ways that, like, if all of a sudden you want, like, I'll watch film of our 4-by and I will show it in film of clips of, hey, why did you throw the ball forward here? Why did you throw the ball back here? Why did you roll away here? Why did you do this? And if they start to take those games more seriously, then they're actually not only getting the decision making, but they're actually getting the reinforcement of, like, what is the right decision? That's why, at the end of the day, and that's really what I want to create, is like those games are competitive. Like, those guys are at times, like, there's scuffles, there's debates about, I mean, holy cow, there was one 2 weeks ago where there was a heat call early in the game and then another heat call late in the game that there was questions on, and it led to a championship, and guys were heated about it. But that's like the environment that we want to create, because at the end of the day, if they are in those competitive environments over and over and over, then they're going to be good in those competitive environments when we do go 6-on-6, when we do get into a game. So,
And
like,
look, people want to compete. It's
they
not that
want
hard to get your guys to compete. You just keep score and give somebody all you
keep
got to
score,
do.
put a time on it, right? Like, tell the defense to do a certain thing. And sometimes when you tell them to do a certain thing and then they start losing, then they start to get pissed off, and you got to manage that, right? Like, there are certain aspects to it that, like, I think originally when I first started playing 4-by, I was a little bit like too loose about it. And I don't know if I was helping them get, like, actually evaluate the decisions that they were making. And now I've kind of tried to get it to a point where, like, it matters. Every game matters. And like, you know, in film, we're not only watching the clips from the game before. Like, we may be talking about a decision. We may be talking about one decision, an entire film session, and it may be an off-ball action in a four-by game that led to somebody scoring five passes later. So, like, if you can be really detail-oriented in that and understand that, like, if they take ownership and they actually understand that it those games matter and there's something to it, there's something at the end of it, then I think that you actually get more out of it than just, sure, like, kind of saying, hey, we're going to play four-by and yeah, it's just going to be fun, right? Like, it's going to be fun because of the
fun. It is good, but, you know, and there's all different ways to do it. You know, I mean, anytime you're trying to win, you know, it's great. But you got to find that balance, too, between – you know, allowing people to be creative and experiment.
Yep.
You know, because where else are they going to do it? And at the same time, trying to win. And you can also, you know, with different scoring systems, you know, you can kind of get what you want too. It's another constraint, but you know, you can make 2 points for a nation's look, or you can make it like, oh, you know, you can say, if you feel like you're turning the ball over too much, you can say, okay, well, you can win the game after 3 minutes by being ahead, or you can lose the game with three turnovers.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I do one where they only have a couple. They only have 3 balls for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And if they there have been times where, or 5 balls for 20 minutes, let's say, or an 8 to 12 minute segment. And if those balls are turned over, they're standing there for the rest of the 12 minutes. Like, now you're getting the reinforcement of not wanting to turn the ball over. So, you know, there are different ways of putting different rules on it, that
getting what you want without making them do it. Or even having to say anything or yell at them, because it doesn't even matter. Like, it's just like, all right, well, you're out. You know, you lost your ball.
Yeah, you're now waiting for the next drill. Make sure you stay warm.
I want to thank you for coming on and talking lacrosse. I mean, what a really fun conversation we just had. And I could probably go on for 2 more hours, but I'm sure you got stuff to do, and I do too. But good luck this year. Have a great holiday, and thank you so much for all the sharing. And let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, man, you got it. Thank you.
See you, John.